Arthur, he said stiffly. Since the day I'd left Verena, we'd scarcely spoken a word, so I simply answered, Mr. Randolph.
They make a handsome couple,
my husband said, eyeing Jack, who whirled my sister around so that her petticoat swirled up under her skirt, heedless of her injured ankle.
Your father says Jack's a talented lawyer.
Truthfully, Jack wasn't terribly talented at anything, in my opinion. Certainly my sister's new husband didn't have Tom's intellect or scientific curiosity. And where my husband had a manly swagger, Jack still presented himself as a pudgy-cheeked boy. There wasn't anything better about Jack Epps but his temper. Yet he had a patrimony and a father who loved him. Two things Tom envied. Two things Tom would never have. And I hurt for him. But I couldn't let my husband's jealousy or fears put a damper on my sister's wedding. So I put my hand on his arm, where it rested upon the colorful buffalo robe on display over the rail, and said, I think I forgot to tell you. My father is hoping to compare his meteorology book with yours. He doesn't trust anyone else's. Shaking my head with feigned bewilderment, I added, You two and your record-keeping. Two peas in a pod, you are. I can't imagine how your scientific minds work.
Your father likes Jack,
Tom said, an edge in his voice. Frustrated, I said, Everybody likes Jack, and Jack likes everybody.
No, he doesn't. He's all pretense,
Tom said, finishing his drink in one gulp.
He proposed to your sister because his parents wanted him to.
Which, even if true, was no bad reason for marriage. Don't spoil things, Tom. Setting his glass down, he lowered his eyes.
Say what you will, Martha, but I wanted you. And I still do.
It softened me to hear it. And I smoothed my hands over the bodice of my gown, knowing that the striped silk taffeta in shades of gold brought out the fiery hues in my curled hair. Then why don't you come downstairs and dance with me? Taking his hand, I drew it to my hip. Look at our guests flapping about without any grace. They need our example.
Patsy,
Tom said, his fist balling within my grasp.
I'm trying to tell you something.
His throat bobbed, as if he was mustering courage.
It pains me to be an embarrassment to you, but I don't know how to remedy my flaws. All I know is that whenever I feel strongly compelled to any act, a doubt always arises. And whereas the voice of reason is low and persuasive, passion is loud and imperious.
It was a kind of apology. And I was reminded again that there was no guile in my husband. What he thought, what he felt, was always there on his skin. He wasn't a diplomat. He wrestled every day with the necessary fictions of gentility that came so easily to me and my father, born politicians that we were. Sometimes Tom's directness was refreshing, intoxicating even. Tom finished by saying,
I wish I knew what part of my nature prevents me from being happy.
I knew exactly what part of his nature was to blame.
It was the Randolph in him.
And when I considered his miserable father, his shameless sisters, and all his selfish, hot-headed kin, I counted it a miracle that Tom was, at heart, a good man. That he wasn't a happy man couldn't be counted much against him. So I pushed onto my toes and kissed him, very softly, at the corner of his mouth. Ask me to dance, Mr. Randolph. And when he finally swept me onto the dance floor, I whispered, I'll tell you a secret about being happy, Tom. Sometimes you just have to pretend at it until it becomes real. Monticello, 11 October, 1798. From Thomas Jefferson to Stevens Thompson Mason.
These alien and sedition laws are merely an experiment on the American mind to see how far it will bear a violation of the Constitution. If this goes down, we shall see another act of Congress declaring a hereditary president for life, or the restoration of His Most Gracious Majesty, George III. That these things are in contemplation, I have no doubt, after the dupery of which our countrymen have shown themselves susceptible.
My husband snapped open his paper at the breakfast table.
This damnable J-tree is going to be our undoing.
I wish he hadn't said it. Only because I didn't want Papa agitated about politics during his visit. In some ways, we all lived in a state of suspended animation until my father came home each autumn, and I didn't want to spoil our time together. Unfortunately, Tom's words worked Papa into a rare state of heat.
For President Adams to side with Britain against France.
Papa fumed, glancing at Tom's paper and adjusting the spectacles he'd purchased for his sore eyes.
Against our sister republic, our lone ally in a world of monarchies.
The treaty had gone down badly. Violence between political factions broke out in Philadelphia and had to be dispersed by light cavalry, much as in Paris on the eve of revolution. What's more, President Adams had authorized the prosecution of critics of the president's administration, which now included my father, his vice president. Federalists claimed these measures were necessary to keep anarchy and the guillotine from American shores. But we saw in this the possibility for the very end of the American experiment with liberty. We were afraid to write political letters of any kind for fear of being jailed, especially since Papa was certain his were being intercepted and read. He removed his spectacles and rested them upon the ledge of the small mahogany lap desk he once used to draft the Declaration of Independence itself, then gave a mournful sigh.
I know not which mortifies me most, that I should fear to write what I think, or that my country bears such a state of things.
Papa, I said, trying to soothe him, perhaps you should resign the vice presidency in protest. Retire early, because in a very short time there will be another election, and it shall all be someone else's worry.
Papa should have agreed with me.
He might at least have pretended to think about it, especially considering the weight it would take off Tom. Instead, Papa snapped,
"This reign of witches must end."
That was the moment I realized my father was going to run for the presidency. Not be reluctantly volunteered, but actively campaign for the office. He was ready for rebellion. Papa's powerful, implacable political outrage reminded me that underneath his gentility, he would always be a revolutionary. He wouldn't retire. He'd run for the presidency of the United States. And this time, he wanted to win. Like a soldier readying for battle, he'd return to Monticello only to regroup in the bosom of his family. A thing made even plainer to me when he groused,
"Where the devil is Maria? I gave Jack my chariot to make it easier to come, and assured them both the house and servants would be ready to receive them."
But Jack hadn't seen fit to bring my sister home. In fact, we'd scarcely seen Polly since her wedding the year before. In that time, Sally had lost poor little Harriet to some childhood illness and borne my father another child, a boy named Beverly. It must have been some consolation, but babies were fragile, and Papa had already lost so many children, he was apt to guard his heart against loving the new ones too dearly. So my father centered his anxieties on my sister.
"Is she ill?"
Just a newlywed, I said, because if it was an illness, it mysteriously reoccurred whenever it served to excuse a visit to Monticello, and I began to harbor a belief the Epps family was keeping my sister from us once again. My husband had cause to know how very much this upset me, and as we prepared for bed one night, he attempted to raise my spirits against the specter of a holiday without my sister.
"You ought to chaperone the Christmas ball in Charlottesville, Patsy. It promises to be a gay season."
I didn't know about that. I knew Nancy intended to try to find a husband there, in spite of her blackened reputation, and Tom's littlest sister, Jenny, would come out into society for the first time. I myself hadn't been out in society in years, and couldn't imagine that it'd make me feel any better about missing Polly, or about losing my father to politics for another 4 years. But then Tom added,
"I'll go to the Christmas ball with you. It occurs to me you need a chaperone. One never knows what kind of trouble you might get up to without me, young lady."
Light-hearted flirtation didn't come naturally to Tom, and it warmed me to know that in spite of all his own struggles, he was trying to help me with mine. In my nightdress, I sat on the edge of the bed, my fingers trailing along the neckline. "Mr. Randolph, it's your sisters you need worry about. I'm an old woman of 26 years and quite above reproach." Tom tugged me against the strong muscles of his bare chest and playfully leaned his face close to mine.
"But I might like to give you a stern reprimand or two anyway."
He wanted me. That hadn't changed. Not since the day he'd decided he must have me did his desire wane. Sometimes I thought it was because whenever he made love to me, he was reaching inside me for something more than the love I bore him, reaching for something I couldn't give. But as long as he kept reaching, I thought it would hold us together. So that Christmas, we loaded up Jenny and everyone else we could stuff into the carriage. Tom and I danced and exhausted the youngsters, putting them to shame. We were still laughing when we returned, much to the consternation of our children at Monticello, where we'd left them in Sally's care. When Tom smooched my cheek, our 6-year-old son Jeff, a little heathen who refused to wear shoes even in coldest winter, made an ugly face. His older sister Anne complained bitterly of the unfairness that we hadn't allowed her to come with us, threatening to go to Philadelphia with her grandpapa, who would surely spoil her with cake. And 2-year-old Ellen, a child I named after the daughter I'd lost, promising myself to love her enough for 2 angels, babbled her complaints, clinging to my skirts. Oh, how I loved my little cherubs. And by springtime, I was expecting another. At this news, my husband leapt from his chair to spin me around. Tom wanted another boy. Of course he did. And the knowledge we had another baby coming set him off on a manic fit of activity, building us a new house at Edge Hill. Tobacco was in the ground, and everyone was predicting high prices.
"This will be a good year, Patsy," Tom said. "We'll get a good harvest, sell at the peak of the market, pay off debts, and live easy the rest of our lives. Just you wait and see."
Chapter 24. Verena Plantation. 1st of July, 1799. To Thomas Jefferson, from Thomas Mann Randolph, Jr.
There is a story of an ancient king whose touch turned everything to gold. You will recognize in me the makings of Midas, except that everything I touch turns to dust.
Nothing came up out of the dirt that summer. What plants did grow were small and sickly things, Most farmers lost their entire crop. We lost most of ours. Tom worked desperately to salvage what he could. In the end, he had to rely on tobacco, which was his undoing. That summer, prices reached dizzying heights, but the odious Federalists had suspended commerce with France, the biggest market for Virginia tobacco. By autumn, prices crashed, and we couldn't give it away. My husband had gambled and lost, but he wasn't the only one, not the only one by far. Every man in Virginia suffered that year. That's why I burned this old letter. I thrust it into the flame and watched the edges curl, happy to protect my husband's too earnest heart, as he was never able to do for himself. Tom's bitterness was a cause of much misery in my life, but he came by some of it so honestly that I can't bear to think of people reading this letter and mocking his pain. And so I burn it, gladly, to ash. At the time he wrote this letter, of course, Tom kept from me the magnitude of the financial disaster. It wasn't a wife's place to know the particulars. I was meant to concern myself with raising our children, four in all now, including baby Cornelia, who we'd named after the famous Roman matron, in keeping with the revolutionary spirits of the time. But in the midst of chasing after the little ones, I had guessed that he wouldn't be able to pay the mortgage on Verena, and tried to comfort him, hushing baby Cornelia in my arms. You couldn't know the right time to sell the tobacco, Tom. Nobody could. Besides, the trade embargo with France will expire in the new year, and you can sell then.
By which time it will all have rotted with my luck.
Tom's shout reverberated throughout the house. Then he turned and smashed the wood window frame, sending a crash of icicles down from the impact. He kept punching and punching with his fist, until I feared he might break his hand or the window or both. "Tom!" I cried, and from somewhere in the house I heard one of the older children whimper. My heart hurt to think they might live in fear of their father's temper. I thought it might do us some good to go somewhere, get away from our troubles for the Christmas holiday, as we'd done the year before. We'd been happy dancing in Charlottesville. Maybe we could be happy somewhere Tom didn't feel the walls closing in on him. When he finally stopped punching, I appraised his bleeding knuckles and said, "We should go to Eppington for the holiday. I want to be with Polly for her lying in." My sister was pregnant for the first time, and it was only natural that I'd want to be with her, but Tom gave me a baleful stare.
"You're going nowhere, Martha. You're scarcely out of childbed yourself."
It wasn't true. Cornelia was nearly 5 months old enough to travel. So I argued, "I'm worried for my sister. You know she's prone to illness. Always too sick to come to visit us or to have visitors."
Tom snorted. "So says Jack Epps."
He had a point. Papa had gone from persuasion to pleading to bribery when it came to luring Jack to bring my sister for a visit. But we hadn't seen her in nearly 2 years. "She's all I can think about, Tom."
"All I can think about is tobacco."
"There's nothing you can do about the tobacco. Nothing but brood." Working myself up into a true lather, I said, "My mother died in childbirth, and Polly has her frame. I have a moral duty to be with my sister now."
"It's only your anxiety that makes it so,"
Tom said, pacing. Oh, the irony of Tom accusing me of being overly anxious. But before I could protest, he announced,
"You're not going, Martha, and that's the end of it."
I wanted to argue, but there was something inside my husband that kept twisting and twisting in on itself, and it left him wound so tight I was afraid he might strike me if I dared to argue. Instead, I went downstairs with him and helped dress Jeff. I got one shoe on my son just as he removed the other, which exasperated me, because he needed his shoes and a breakfast of bread and milk before he could make the 2-mile walk to school. And while I tried to wrestle him into his shoes, my squirming son delivered an accidental kick to my belly. I cried out in surprise at the pain, which set my already furious husband off like a powder keg. Tom grabbed our boy and shook him, screaming in his face, "You ever kick your mother again and I'll beat you bloody. Do you hear? I'll beat you down until you can't ever get up again." "Tom!" I struggled to pull a wailing Jeff from his father's grasp. "Stop! It was an accident!" But my husband's hold seemed to tighten the more I fought him. "Tom, please!" The next thing I knew, Jeff was in my shaking arms, the unexpected shifting of his weight against me making me stumble back. Meanwhile, Tom paced, tugging at his hair with one hand.
"He should learn proper respect for his mother."
The time he'd struck me, maybe I deserved it. But I knew from the depths of my soul that my sobbing little boy had done nothing to earn such rough treatment. As I cuddled him close, my heart ached in my chest, and my stomach soured and burned. Because I knew that day that more than just our financial affairs were falling apart. Seeking to escape the troubles unfurling at Verena, I unwittingly brought my children to a tragedy at Monticello. For the winter of 1799 was a reaper of souls in Albemarle. Mammy Ursula's husband and son, affectionately known as the Georges, died of some mysterious ailment. Then my father's old personal servant Jupiter came down with it too. He believed himself poisoned, and against all advice, went to the same black conjure doctor who had treated the Georges. I learned of it after a commotion outside, where my daughter had been playing in the dusting of snow with the slave children, all of whom called for me in a panic. Sally and I both flew out of my father's house to witness a sight I'd never forget. Jupiter had fallen to the cold and muddy road in front of the new carriage house on Mulberry Row, twitching in a convulsion fit so strong that it took 3 stout men to hold him. Catching Anne up by the arms, I tried to quiet her sobs. "What's happened?"
"He took a dram, Mama,"
she said, clinging to me.
"The conjure doctor gave him something that would kill or cure,"
Sally said bitterly, for the doctor had done the same for the Georges, both dead now. "Take the children away," I told Sally quietly, trying to keep my wits about me. Then, to the men holding Jupiter down as he writhed in pain, I commanded, "Take him to a bed, and tell me where this doctor can be found."
"He's long gone, mistress,"
Ursula answered.
"Absconded 2.5 hours ago, after giving Jupiter the potion."
I paced, my skirts dragging as the men lifted up Jupiter's twisted form, his eyes bulging so that we could see the whites, a bloody froth dripping from his lips down the black skin of his neck and into his woolly hair. My heart broke at the sight. I wanted to rail at the servants for trusting such a butcher, but more than that, I wanted Jupiter to be well. I tended him myself. 9 days he languished and never recovered, not even to speak his last words to anybody. Horrified by my failure to protect our people, I was relieved to see Tom ride up to the house. Our troubles seemed suddenly quite small with death all around us. "I should think this doctor's murder's sufficiently manifest to come under the cognizance of the law," I told Tom, wanting justice. "I wrote the same to my father." But my rage all came to nothing. My menfolk raised no fuss. I suppose they were all hoping that Winter's Reaper of Death had absconded away with the murderous doctor and didn't want to call either back. Alas, nature demanded more payments that winter. Sally's newborn daughter died. Polly's baby died. George Washington died, too. Such was the bitter partisanship of the day that my father didn't feel he'd be welcome at the funeral for his friend, our first president, the great Virginian whose Federalist followers mourned him like the king they wished him to be. And I cared nothing about it, because all I could think of was the poisoned slaves I hadn't been able to help, and my poor, grieving sister so far from me. Thanks to Tom, I hadn't made it to her lying in, and I learned about her baby's death back at Edgehill as Winter gasped its last cold breaths. The house Tom built for us was no architectural marvel. It was just a box, no wider than 40 feet and 2 stories high, but it was the first thing we had without the taint of Colonel Randolph on it. Alas, the windows were done badly, and the insides had been spattered with rain and wind and mud come up from the cellar. For days after we arrived, I cleaned from dawn till dusk, sweeping and scrubbing until my hands were raw and cracked, while Tom worked at repairing the windows.
"Martha,"
Tom said a few mornings into our stay. He caught me with the servants in the kitchen, where I was setting up housekeeping. The months of loss had taken a toll on me, and an even worse toll on us, and so I kept my eyes on the piles of dirt I was sweeping and my mouth closed.
"Patsy," he said when I didn't look up, "might I trouble you for a word?"
My husband had spoken sweetly to me ever since learning that my sister's childbirth had come to grief. For my part, I'd scarcely answered him with a word more than was necessary. He'd kept me from my sister when she needed me. I wanted to fly to my sister now and comfort her, but having been disappointed before in doing what perhaps my anxiety only deemed a moral duty, I was afraid to indulge any hopes in the matter. "I'm listening, Mr. Randolph." My broom swished, swished, swished against the rough-hewn planks of the floor, highlighting the stretch of silence between us.
"Your father has advanced me the money to save Verena,"
Tom said sheepishly. I swept harder, whacking the broom against the wall as I did it. Tom heaved a great sigh.
"How can I ever express my gratitude for his kindness? I was really on the point of ruin from my own neglect."
I slammed down a dustpan and collected up the debris with more force than was strictly necessary. Then I yanked open a window and emptied the pan with a clatter. Tom cleared his throat.
"I knew all along that I should have sold my tobacco in full time to meet my debts, but a great price for that crop would have rendered us perfectly easy for life."
He stared at his feet.
"I risked ruin with the hope of fortune, but fear I've only procured embarrassments."
It was the kind of frank admission of fault that Tom was, alone amongst the men I knew, capable of giving. And I worried he had beggared us for the rest of our lives. How long would he really be able to keep Verena, even with my father's help? He should have sold that damned farm, let it go, started fresh. But that's not what I really blamed him for. "My sister is ailing. Her breasts have risen and broke. And this is your fault because you wouldn't let me go to her," was my silent accusation.
He frowned, not needing me to say it. "I'll take you to Eppington, if you still want to go."
We left that very day. And when I saw my sister half dead in a fetid bed, I thought I might swoon away at the shock of seeing her so thin and frail. but my resentment of Tom was utterly eclipsed by my anger at yet another quack physician. This one had Polly confined to bed, taking so much castor oil that she'd wasted away.
My poor Polly. Maria, she whispered with a faint smile, unable to lift her head from the pillow, but fluttering her eyes at me as if grateful that I'd finally come. Childbirth had ravaged her. Even beyond the grief of losing her baby, the damage done to her delicate body was like nothing I'd ever seen. The doctor murmured that she wasn't the sort of woman God made for childbearing, to which my sister replied, "Patsy, rescue me." I vowed I would, because I feared that under his regimen of mysterious elixirs, she might never rise from her bed again. Fortunately, I wasn't the only one stricken by the state of her. Tom was adamant. "She needs to be up and out of that sick bed, and her breasts need to be drained of the swelling." Whether he was dissecting opossums, nursing our children through smallpox, or theorizing how to relieve a new mother's breasts when her baby had died, my husband's peculiar interest in science made me think he would have done better to pursue a career in medicine than farming, and I hoped that Jack Epps would take my husband's advice. Unfortunately, Jack and Tom mixed like oil and water. Maybe it was because Tom seldom laughed at Jack's jokes, or maybe it was because Jack laughed too much at Tom, poking fun at his serious nature. Whatever the reason, Jack defended the physician as an old family friend. "We're perfectly happy with his ministrations to my wife. My apologies for intruding, then," Tom said stiffly, sensing he'd pressed the matter as far as he could in another man's house about another man's wife. But Polly wasn't only the wife of Jack Epps. She was also my sister. I wasn't about to leave it alone. That night, after the fire burned low, I left Polly in the care of her maid, Betsy, another Hemmings girl, and went to find Jack, where he was shutting up for the night. "My sister wants to stretch her legs, breathe in fresh air, get a little food into her without castor oil purging it. Surely you don't want her confined forever, do you?"
"Oh, Patsy," Jack said, giving me a genial pat, "I want her alive and well."
Jack was smiling that glib smile of his, and I had the most unladylike urge to punch it from his face. He was supposed to take care of my sister, to love her and take seriously her ailments. The fact that he could smile at me like that while she wasted away hardened me. "If you truly want her alive and well, Jack, then understand that she can't ever have more children." A planter needed sons, and it was a wife's duty to produce them. I considered it my duty, certainly, but my mother had considered it hers, too, and died trying. "My sister wasn't made for it, Jack. You take one honest look at her, and you'll know it's true."
"What am I supposed to do about it if it is?"
he asked, an edge of anger in his voice. And maybe he had a right to be angry with me. This was an interference of the highest order, but in the past months I had not been vigilant enough. "Stay off her," I said. "For the love of God, Jack, stay off her." He stared at me a moment, shocked, but then all the masks fell away, and he hung his head as if in shame. I put a hand on his shoulder to soothe him, and was rewarded with Jack's teary nod. Papa was dead, or so it was reported that summer. When the presidential campaign for the election of 1800 was in full swing, and the newspapers were hard at work with vile slanders, my father was said to be dead, an atheist, and a coward,
President Adams was said to be a tyrant and a criminal. My father was said to be a swindler begot by a mulatto upon a half-breed Indian squaw. President Adams was said to be a hermaphrodite. It would have been laughable if the stakes weren't so high. Indeed, I worried that my poor sister would hear the news of my father's passing before we could tell her the truth, and that it might stop her frail heart. It vexed me that she wasn't with us at Monticello, where Papa desired us all to join him. Jack Epps had promised they'd come, but now he pled the excuse of the harvest, even though we all knew perfectly well my sister would be of no use to him on the farm. If Jack had let her come with us, I wouldn't have to fret for her like I did. Or, at the very least, I'd have someone other than Sally with whom to share my amazement at the circus in my father's house that summer. Though we lived in the same house, I scarcely saw Papa, for he was always in a crowd. Politicians, financiers, and newspaper men flocked to our mountaintop to pay court to the man they wanted for their next president. They behaved as if he belonged to them, and I suppose he must have. But at night, when he retired to his private chambers, he belonged to Sally. For even though we had a house full of guests, he recklessly got her with child again by autumn. And while Sally tended to Papa, I was left to cater to my father's guests, men and their wives who hadn't waited on an invitation, but nevertheless needed to be fed and offered every hospitality. They ran over us like locusts, and it reminded me of the weeks we were under siege by the British, and the legislators gathered together at Monticello to avoid capture. There were no dragoons hunting us now, but there may as well have been for all the chaos, as if, in campaigning for the presidency, they were bringing about a new revolution. For my part, I wanted none of it. If only Papa's candidacy had been the most troubling thing we faced. In early September, alarming news reached us from our longtime neighbor and friend, Mr. Monroe, now the governor of Virginia.
"I've just received word,"
Papa said, indicating a letter he held in a shaking hand, and a crowd drew round him in the entryway.
"The planned slave insurrection in Henrico has been clearly proved. 10 Negroes have already been condemned and executed, and there are upward of 40 more to be tried."
While the crowd of men murmured at the news, I held my breath. News of a possible slave rebellion near Richmond had reached us days before, but the terrifying specifics of the plot were just now becoming clear. Verena was in Henrico County. Had Tom's slaves been involved? And what if Tom had been at Verena when the violence began?
"As many as 40 more, you say?"
one of the men asked, as if startled to learn so many slaves would be willing to take up against their masters in concerted effort. To imagine slaves killing whites and setting fire to the Virginia countryside, not in far-off Haiti, but actually here, was a thing of which not a few slaveholders' nightmares were made. Though he usually hung back in a crowd, Tom frowned and shook his head, saying,
"Were it not for a thunderstorm thwarting their plans, who knows how many more might have joined them?"
This comment caused an uproar with our guests, some of whom opined that these rebel slaves ought to be made terrible example of. But Papa wandered off while they ranted, and they didn't seem to notice his leaving. Tom and I followed him into the solitude of his study, where the wavering candlelight cast Papa's big shadow upon the octagonal walls. I looked from my husband's face to the parchment in Papa's hand, and dared to ask, "What else does Mr. Monroe say?" Papa sighed and rubbed his forehead.
"He wishes to know my opinion on how to deal with the conspirators."
This had been a frequent topic of conversation at our dinner table amongst Papa's guests, who also wished to know his thoughts, as it seemed everyone did on every topic these days. After a long moment of silence, I asked, "What will you say?" Laying the letter upon an open ledger, Papa sat in his red revolving chair.
"This is unquestionably the most serious and formidable conspiracy we've ever known in these parts. But there's been hanging enough."
Tom nodded his agreement.
"We open ourselves for condemnation if we indulge in a principle of revenge, or go one step beyond absolute necessity."
"Indeed," Papa said. "The problem is how to strike the balance between justice and public safety."
Sally knocked as she came in from the greenhouse, interrupting the conversation with the news that more guests had arrived. "I'll greet them," I said wearily, gathering my skirts. As I passed Sally, I wondered what she knew of this rebellion. What did any of the slaves at Monticello know of it? For the instigators had reportedly gathered support from slaves as far away as Charlottesville. And I'd long ago seen proof of how quickly important news traveled amongst the slaves. Out in the hall, I took a moment to gather myself before I greeted our visitors. My father had once said on the eve of the Constitutional Convention, with respect to the dangers of a failed rebellion in Massachusetts, that the tree of liberty must be refreshed from time to time with the blood of patriots and tyrants. Only, here and now, with so much in turmoil in our young nation, I couldn't help but wonder who was who. Chapter 25. Washington City, 16 January, 1801. From Thomas Jefferson to Martha Jefferson Randolph.
Here one feels in an enemy's country. It is an unpleasant circumstance, if I am destined to stay here, that the great proportion are Federalists, most of them of the violent kind. Some have been so personally bitter that they threaten a dissolution of the government if I'm elected.
We were infested, not merely with the vermin and detritus of politics, but also with the dreaded itch at Edgehill. "Hold still," I told my son Jeff, shearing off as much of his hair as possible, to rid him of the nits he'd caught running about with an apprentice boy. Though it was winter, I was covered in sweat from the nearby cauldron in our yard where I was boiling his clothes, and I felt agitated and upset at every little thing. Why, I was even cross with Anne, because I'd told her to finish her Latin translation, but she'd abandoned her books to watch her brother's delousing. In truth, since taking upon myself the education of the children, I was beginning to believe that both of my eldest were uncommonly backward. Jeff was a willful hooligan who couldn't read without moving his lips. Anne had a good memory, but never applied it without prompting. Only 4-year-old Ellen, who was smart enough for 2 little girls, showed any aptitude for learning. I knew I ought to have been satisfied if my children turned out well with regard to morals, but I could never sit quietly under the idea of my father's grandchildren being blockheads. Still, I told myself to be content with the idea of my son as a simple but industrious farmer, because blockheads weren't likely to run for president. That's what I was thinking when my stomach cramped so hard that I doubled over. I went down onto the cold ground to retch. Heaving into the grass, I was so very sick I had to crawl my way back into the house. The sickness came in waves, and I could tolerate neither meat nor milk nor coffee. We thought I might be with child again. I was with child, as it happened. But Tom thought it was more than that.
It isn't healthful the way you hold your feelings in and push them down, he said,
as if I'd somehow reached the limits of emotions my body would allow me to suppress. Sitting on the edge of my bed, his big hand closing reassuringly on my knee, Tom said,
I know the election worries you, but nothing is going to happen to your father.
You can't know that, I said, vexed that Tom had somehow guessed at exactly the fears that consumed me. He's surrounded by violent men who will do anything to prevent him coming to power.
He's beloved of the people.
Lafayette was beloved of the people, too. And they threw him in a dungeon anyway. Unlike Tom, I'd already lived through two revolutions, and I was certain we were in the paroxysms of a third. The Federalists bayed that if my father were allowed to take the presidency, murder, robbery, rape, adultery, and incest would be openly practiced, the soil soaked with blood, and the nation black with crimes, which made me sure that they meant to kill him or usurp the government. I was equally sure there'd be chains, dungeons, and the gibbet for his supporters, to say nothing of his children and grandchildren. I wasn't alone in my fears. Everyone now talked of civil war, and militias were being mustered. I'd seen this before in France. Shouts of violence turned into bloody mayhem. I couldn't count the revolutionaries I'd known who had, in the end, been eaten by the nation they birthed. As it was, the French Republic was still careening from constitution to directorship to the authority of General Bonaparte, and still the will of the people hadn't triumphed. So even though my father's Republican Party had swept the election, taking both houses of Congress and the presidency besides, the Federalists weren't prepared to surrender the government. A constitutional defect had allowed a tie between my father and his running mate, Aaron Burr, and now, in a spirit of perpetual war, the vanquished monarchists threatened to make mischief by elevating Burr to the presidency instead of Papa. But I knew there was a far easier way to keep my father from the presidency. They could, for example, send him the bullet I'd been shielding him from since I was a child. And I couldn't sleep, eat, or defeat the guilt consuming me for having secretly wished the Federalists would prevail, for having wished Papa would lose the election and come home to set things right, because it was all, everything, coming apart. Even my silence. I'm so very worried, Tom. We have 4 children and another on the way. We've a house that's cold and wet and too small. I bit my lip. I knew wives weren't supposed to know anything about the business of planting, but I was expected to manage the economy of the household, and how could I do it without knowing how bad off we were? How are we going to pay our debts? How will we survive?
We'll live on the profits from wheat this year,
Tom said, rising to pace at the foot of my bed,
and give up on tobacco.
I peered up at him through bleary eyes. I hope so, Tom. Then a sudden clenching pain had me groaning and curling into a sweaty ball. Tom rushed back to swab my forehead with a cool cloth on the nightstand. Sitting on the edge of the bed, he rubbed my back and whispered soothingly until the cramps eased off. Later, after I'd managed a few hours of fitful sleep, he came back with some tea, still warm from the kettle.
You're letting everything frighten you, Patsy. Trust in me to take care of you. Trust in your father to take care of himself. The Federalists don't have to kill Mr. Jefferson to keep him from claiming the presidency. They just have to resort to legal trickery, and they've shown a willingness to do it. Because of the tie vote, the House of Representatives says they may choose neither candidate and settle upon John Marshall instead.
John Marshall. I remembered that man from the trial of Richard Randolph. His cool eyes appraising me as I stood there with lies on my tongue and my hand on his Bible. It horrified me to think he might become president. But my husband continued on with his thoughtful and admittedly well-reasoned assessment.
Either way, it won't come to a fight. In spite of all the saber-rattling, your father won't lead us into war. He doesn't want the presidency that much. The Federalists won't go to war either, because above all, they cannot bear anarchy and disorder. That's the one thing they have in common with your father.
He was right. My father was a man of routines, civility, and particularity. In France, at the height of the danger, he'd encouraged Lafayette and the others to principled stands, but pragmatic compromise. He often told them to take what they could get in the hopes of pressing for more later. Papa could write fiery screeds, but he was, in fact, an even-tempered, rational actor. And in the end, we were all saved by it. By my father's temperament, his reputation, and the respect of his enemies. What else can explain the way Alexander Hamilton stepped into the breach to resolve the crisis? Yes, my father's bitterest foe threw his full weight behind my father's election to the presidency. Hamilton hated my father, but he hated Aaron Burr, and perhaps John Marshall, much more. After the House of Representatives voted 35 times in a deadlock, on the 36th ballot, my father was elected, peacefully and democratically, to the presidency of the United States. Papa and his partisans called it the Revolution of 1800. Our countrymen delivered the nation into my father's hands. With much hue and outcry and paroxysms of bitter slander, but ultimately without blood. Power passed from one faction to the other in accordance with the wishes of the people, and the rule of law was obeyed. It was the first time such a thing had ever happened in our country, or perhaps anywhere. Papa wanted my sister and I to rejoice, insisting we make annual visits to the presidential mansion, and promising that he'd return to Monticello so often we'd be together 4 or 5 months of the year. But it was a plan that ignored reality. With all our little children running afoot, Tom couldn't do without me, and Jack Epps couldn't stay off my sister. Polly gave birth to a little boy at the end of September, and somehow it didn't kill her, but she was so ill that she fled to me, fearful of the physicians near Eppington. When I felt how thin she was in my embrace, I cried, "Polly, you look so unwell." My nephew was a fragile creature who had still somehow robbed his mother of nearly all her life's blood. Her pallor was deathly, and as unreasonable as it was, I blamed Jack Epps for that. "You're white as a ghost and thin as a scarecrow." Cradling her delicate new baby boy, she smiled softly. "Mr. Epps is so happy to have a son that he says I've never looked prettier. Besides, we can't all breathe so easily and often as you do, Patsy. Why, look at you, set to give birth yourself any day now, and you're trying to haul my baggage into your house."
"I'll carry it," my son Jeff said, always a little helper even then. Though I couldn't get him to crack open a book without bribery or threat, he was a sweet boy, and I was grateful that he dragged my sister's trunk into the house so I could get her inside.
"I'm fine, Patsy," Polly insisted as my daughters crowded around. But she wasn't fine. She was so weak she needed to be helped up the stairs. At which point I realized how much nursing she required, and given how ill I had been during the election and how ailing I still felt now, I determined that I'd have to have my baby at Monticello, where at least I could count on Sally's help. Truly, I longed for my father's house, the attentions of his servants, windows that didn't leak, and a bed to birth my baby that was comfortable and clean. After all the terrors of the election, I wanted nothing more than sweet seclusion with my family now. But in that simple desire, I was to be utterly thwarted. For when Papa came riding up his mountain that summer to fetch us home, he was accompanied by a multitude. Neighbors, relatives, well-wishers, sycophants, and every manner of hanger-on all ascended with him, calling, "President Jefferson! President Jefferson!" He rejected all trappings of monarchy, but our guests flooded about him like courtiers attending a king. Except royal courtiers, as I recalled from France, had duties and obligations to their sovereign. Royal courtiers were bound by strict rules of etiquette and social niceties. Royal courtiers didn't demand berths without invitation. Royal courtiers didn't lounge about in various states of dress, insolently ordering servants who were not theirs to command. There was very little I could do about it, however, because my father insisted that as a man of the people, there must be no formality in our entertaining. During the mornings, I planned the menu, then waddled up and down the narrow staircase with my big pregnant belly to unlock the storerooms and cabinets so the servants could keep our guests fed. After meals, I played music to entertain, or chased after the children, though my ankles had swollen up so much that my shoes were painful. And by evening, I tended to my sister, who was still too weak to leave her bed. Perhaps realizing how weary I was, Papa promised, "Next time I visit, I'm resolved to do a flying visit by stealth, telling no one but you that I'm coming." On the night my labor pains started, I surprised myself with the thought that I was happy for the pain, because it had confined me to childbed where I could rest. After a hard night of panting and pushing, I gave birth to a little girl, and Sally swaddled my baby with crisp efficiency. Later, she and Polly sat with me while I nursed my newborn child, the three of us reminiscing about Paris, a time when all options were open before us. Those memories were preserved forever in our minds, like bubbles suspended eternally in glittering glass. Sally liked to speak of them, though whenever she spoke in French, it annoyed the other slaves. It set her apart, served as a reminder that she was my father's pretty, genteel, sophisticated mistress. Sometimes I worried about those resentments and jealousies, but on this night, I only enjoyed our reunion, all three of us with babies at the breast. Sally was nursing little Harriet, named after her poor daughter who died, but this Harriet, who was as pale and rosy as any little white child, also had my father's piercing blue eyes. I think Sally loved her best, and how couldn't she? After all, Harriet, like my Ellen, must be treasured enough for two daughters. But, of course, daughters were of little help to a planter. Sons were prized, even ones who foamed at the mouth in fits like my sister's baby Francis. "Poor little thing," Sally said to me when my sister drifted to sleep. I thought she meant Francis, but her amber eyes settled on Polly, with as much worry as I felt in my own heart. "Miss Polly won't survive another. She gave Mr. Epps a son now, That ought to be enough for him.
No other slave would ever dare say such a thing, but I wouldn't scold Sally for it.